Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Trust Company AMC call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Ian Bruch. Thank you. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, and thank you. As a reminder, information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk and, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. First, consult with a qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed on today's call. Well, good morning. This is Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer. Welcome to our Asset Management Committee call. Today is June 4th. We appreciate you joining us today. As always, I am joined by the broader investment team, which includes Tim Vick here in our Naples market, and our Sanibel team of portfolio managers, which includes Craig Holston, Ed Siskowski, Joel Johnson, and Gary Dyer. And up in Tampa, we have Andrew Vanderhorst today as well. Just to continue on the trend of the last several weeks, share a quick update on where we stand in terms of COVID infections. We're now at about 6.5 million cases globally since the beginning of all this. We're still growing globally at about a 1.8% daily growth rate. That's been fairly consistent week over week. I think last week it was 1.9%, so just under 2% growing globally. And again, the overall trend continues where we're seeing the United States and Europe, which were most hardest hit three or four weeks ago, really slow down, which is great news. In the meantime, countries like Brazil and Russia are really ramping up in terms of their caseload, which is keeping that overall global growth rate fairly consistent. We have about 1.9 million cases here in the United States, and again, we're growing at just over 1% per day, and that's been fairly consistent week over week at this point. And I mentioned Europe growth is really even slower than it is in the United States, which is good. And between Brazil and Russia, you know, I think Brazil's probably a little bit more concerning in that they, you know, there's 50 million more people in Brazil than there is in Russia. You've got some large, dense population centers like Rio and Sao Paulo, just to name a few. And they're also entering, we often forget here in the Northern Hemisphere, they're entering their winter months right now. So June and July are some of their colder months. So Brazil in the short term is probably a little bit more concerning than Russia at this point. But we'll continue to see how this plays itself out over the summer months. From a market standpoint, as we sit here through last night, the S&P 500 is really only down, I think, 3 to 4% year to date, which really just shows the significant rebound in stock prices we continue to see play out since the middle of the latter part of March, where we hit those really low points. So it's good to get it. We're happy it's happened. But as I sit here today, the market only being down 3 to 4% is frankly a little surprising, and I think it speaks to why we try to stay away from predicting what's going to happen in the stock market over the next few weeks or few months, because you're perpetually surprised by what can happen in the short term. From an economic standpoint, we got unemployment numbers again. Unemployment claims came in at 1.877 million this morning, which was roughly what was expected by economists. Again, it's a historically large number, very large, like we've become almost accustomed to over the last several weeks, but at least it's trending in the right direction. So we are continuing to see unemployment claims fall, even though the overall numbers are still quite astounding. We do expect to get an unemployment rate number for the month of May, and that'll come out tomorrow on Friday, June 5th. But right now, I think consensus estimates for the new unemployment rate is going to be right around 19.5%, up from the April read, which was 14.7%. So again, we continue to see those unemployment claims week over week feed into the overall unemployment rate. We did get a modestly positive sign from the ADP payroll data yesterday, but it doesn't tell the full story. We'll get a much better sense of things tomorrow morning when they release the new unemployment numbers. And again, that's a metric that we're following pretty closely, given that it's probably the one economic data point that is going to take the longest to kind of unwind and get back to a more favorable level. Unemployment, high levels of unemployment are probably going to be around for a while here. It takes a while to kind of rework that through the system and get people back into new productive jobs. And a lot of that's going to depend on, you know, the capacity of consumers to spend, obviously. Right now, stimulus checks have come and unemployment benefits are being paid, and that's keeping the wheels turning. But obviously, we need the unemployment picture to get better as soon as possible as we reopen economies across the globe. We're continuing to see that. The United States particularly is taking more and more measures to kind of restart the economy. We're seeing that also take place in Europe and other areas that have surpassed kind of the worst time period of infections. Other economic news I just wanted to touch on briefly, Christine Lagarde, the European Central Bank president, announced a big increase in their bond purchase program by about $1.5 trillion, which is notable in that they're now being almost as aggressive as what our own Fed has done in terms of providing liquidity to the markets. So that was interesting to see. And I also think it's clear that central bankers and economists are being more aggressive in the midst of this than really they ever have been. And I think as you work your way through every new crisis, now you have a new historical context by which to make decisions off of. And you're seeing central banks across the globe throw a lot of money at this problem in the short term as a way to try to dampen the economic impact as we come out of this. It's something we always used to mention, I just wanted to touch on it today. On our asset management committee calls, we would often mention the Fed model. And the Fed model is just a measure of valuing stocks versus bonds. We've had obviously a lot of movement in stock and bond prices here over the last few months. Interest rates have really fallen again to historically low levels. And what the Fed model does is it basically compares the earnings yield on stocks, we'll call it the S&P 500, and the earnings yield on a 10-year Treasury bond. And as has been the case for a number of years, and it's just even more pronounced now, if you hold everything else equal, stocks versus bonds, stocks are a much better value longer term than bonds. The other side of that, though, is that, you know, that gives you no assessment of risk, obviously. It stands to reason that you should expect more earnings off of a stock, but we've really seen the difference between stocks and bonds and an earnings yield only increase in the midst of this pandemic as interest rates have fallen. Now, it's really a reason why over the last, let's call it decade or so, we've been encouraging our clients to take a more equity-heavy approach, being heavily into stocks for the long term, given the much better earnings dynamics versus bonds. That still remains true today. However, it's also reasonable to take a look out at the world and from an economic landscape and also in conjunction with your own personal goals and what you're trying to accomplish with your money. It's reasonable to have a portion of bonds as a part of your portfolio to the extent you want to reduce risk. So we treat bonds as in simple terms, as a slightly better alternative to holding cash right now. Again, interest rates, as we all know, are exceedingly low. So it's not going to be the most exciting portion of your portfolio. There's no right or wrong answer as to how much or how little you have in stocks versus bonds. It's just a good reminder that stocks today are as attractive as they've ever been relative to bonds. But again, we have to consider risk levels within accounts. And again, that's why we do all of our portfolio management work at the individual account relationship level. We really want to know what it is we're trying to accomplish on your behalf and build a portfolio that meets those objectives. And if that means having a majority in bonds or a majority in stocks, we'll move in that direction. So with that said, I'm going to move it over to Tim. And Tim, a subject that's come up in discussions recently is just Berkshire Hathaway, which is a large conglomerate holding that we've held in client accounts for a long period of time. I just wanted to get your sense, and since you follow that company and Warren Buffett probably closer than any of us on our investment team, What are your thoughts in terms of just Berkshire's business today? Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Ian, and a pleasant Thursday to everybody. And we're always delighted that you chose to join us this morning. And again, thanks for that question on Berkshire Hathaway. As some of you might know, my love affair with Berkshire goes way, way back, probably to the mid-1990s, when I first studied Warren Buffett's methods about him extensively. And, you know, back then, of course, Berkshire was what we'd call a high-octane investment. The company was much, much smaller, so it had a longer and wider runway of growth ahead of it. It was very opportunistic in the way it took advantage of market situations, and Warren Buffett made some very timely investments at that time. And its insurance subsidiaries, which were really the core of Berkshire Hathaway back then, were generating lots of excess cash to reinvest. So Berkshire had a beautiful business model that really was able to beat the S&P 500 and by a wide margin for a long period of time. So we kept an eye on it for a long time until we could find the price at which we could get into it ourselves. So fast forward, I think, to about 2011, and we noticed that the stock had fallen all the way back down to its book value. And that was, I think, the first time I had seen that kind of low valuation for Berkshire since the 87 crash. And we swooped in for the first time and started buying shares for clients. And that allowed us to keep following it and understand the metrics and the valuation of the company very closely. And within days of those first purchases in 2011, the company announced it was buying back shares if the shares kept trading around book value. So that really formed the bottom of that stock in 2011. It was off to the races from there. And I think Berkshire from then on has provided investors about a 12-13% annualized return, even including this decline in the share price recently. And we kept buying occasionally until, I would say, mid-2019, when I put a halt on it. At that point, I think the B shares were trading around $205 a share. And I noticed some things that were starting concerned me about the company and its business model and such. And, you know, first of all, the valuation was getting stretched. Berkshire had loaded up on stocks like Financials Bank America. It had bought a huge slug of Apple computer stock, airline stocks. And the rallies in those equities were actually pushing up Berkshire's valuation and probably artificially propping up the valuation of that stock. So that was concerning to us. And we also noticed that Warren Buffett himself was getting a little more lax on the acquisition front. He was letting cash pile up, and that was going to lower the returns on capital, the returns on equity. Buffett really hadn't made a large acquisition in a while. Going back this decade, he had bought Lubrizol, and he bought Home Services of America and Orion Trading. He had bought Heinz in 2014. He made a big acquisition of Precision Cast Parts in 2016, and bought an interest in the Flying J truck stops, I think, in 2017, but nothing since. So the fact that this cash was piling up was a bit of a concern to us. And also we noticed that the core businesses, the railroad, the utilities, the machinery stocks, GEICO, they all seemed to be slowing down simultaneously. And then, of course, adding on to that was this, let's call it a pretty disastrous merger between Kraft and Heinz that Warren Buffett helped engineer, which destroyed about half the value that Buffett had placed in those companies. So it really, this kind of Buffett premium that we had come to understand with Berkshire, the fact that it could trade for a higher premium to its book value, its earnings, based on the fact that Buffett could keep making key acquisitions to keep going, we're to keep up with the S&P 500.
Tim, if you could just pause a moment. I think you're – are you still there with us? I think your audio is failing us.
Yes, I am. Yes, can
okay,
you hear
go
me?
Ahead. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. So the situation is, where does Berkshire fit inside of a client's account? You know, on the one hand, it doesn't provide a dividend, so it's not income stock. And it's a slow-growing company, so it's not a growth stock anymore. So it's more a safety play, not – right now. It's a modest growing company with a fortress-like balance sheet, and we really assessed it as a company that it's not going to hurt you anymore, but we don't feel like it was going to help your portfolio as it did in the past. So one client at a time, we're kind of passing the torch to other franchise investments like Berkshire that we can keep in portfolios for the next 5 or 10 years or so. And you know, by and large, the average client has done pretty well with Berkshire. They're probably about 50% on each recent or near break even, and clients have tripled their money if they got in 2011, 2012. So all in all, in our venture with Berkshire over these years, we feel pretty good about the decisions we've made. both the purchases and the sales, but we are getting to the point where we know it's time to move on. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate that update. Joel, if I could send it over to you, because I think one of the things we've heard from clients and we hear it in advertisements on TV is just given the amount of stimulus spending that's going on to try and work our way, the amount of leverage we've added to our own national balance sheet obviously is reason for concern, I think, longer term, and it brings the gold and precious metal discussion to the fore again. Could you just comment on gold and your thoughts on that area? Thanks.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Ian, and good morning, everybody. I'm excited to talk about this because gold comes up more and more often, especially as we see months like we did back in March where we see a lot of volatility in the market. Clients will come to us and they hear a lot of untruths about gold, and I want to go through a couple of those today. And the first one I'll touch on is what Ian was just talking about, and that's the idea that gold is a good hedge against inflation. And that is actually true. Gold has outpaced inflation over the long term, but we think that there is a better way to achieve that goal of beating inflation. And we think stocks as a whole do a better job than gold does. So if we look at the Spider Gold Shares ETF, which is the largest one out there that investors purchase, and we compare that to the S&P 500, just on a price basis, stocks over the last 5 years have outpaced gold. On top of that, what a lot of these stocks do is pay dividends. Gold does not. When these companies are paying us dividends, and especially the individual companies that we purchase, they tend to increase those dividends any year that they can. And a lot of times, just that dividend increase will outpace inflation. Inflation has been about 3%. Over the long term, and we can see dividend increases for some of our companies be anywhere from 3% all the way up to 10% in some cases in some years. So equities as a whole tend to be a better hedge against inflation over the long term than gold. Another thing that we hear a lot of clients say is that gold is less volatile than the overall market. This too is actually not true. There is a measure out there called standard deviation that we can look at. And what standard deviation tells us is the amount of movement, the ups and downs of a particular asset or stock. So again, if we look at that gold ETF versus the S&P 500, that gold ETF actually fluctuates about 5% in any given month. And that trend has been fairly steady, whereas the stock market is about 4.5% or so. So stocks are actually less volatile. And I think we can chalk that up to the fact that gold is very much based on what people are willing to pay for it. There isn't anything underlying for the value of what gold should be. Whereas stocks, we have earnings, we have sales from these companies, again, going back to those dividends, we can actually put a value on all of that. So the fact that we are really relying on people's sentiment about gold, a lot of times the fear of the overall market driving that price actually tends to make gold much more volatile. I will say that we do have gold in some client portfolios, and there's a few reasons for that, is that sometimes in a well-balanced portfolio, if you're looking at an asset allocation and there's something called the efficient frontier that some people like to look at, gold does actually reduce the overall volatility of a portfolio, and that's because it's not correlated to the stock market. So typically, if you see big dips in the stock market, gold will go up during that short term. Again, we like to look at long term, so that's not a reason for us to invest in gold, but that is a point that we want to point out. The other reason we would own gold in a client's account is because it feels good to the client. Again, going back to that feeling and what gold is worth to an individual, that's going to differ from person to person, and it really drives the price of gold. So if it makes a client feel better to just say we have a certain percentage in this metal, we'll do it for them. But again, we think and we know that there are better ways to achieve the goal that you are trying to achieve by buying gold with equities, bonds, and other investments. So gold isn't an awful investment. It's something to be aware of, and it's something you should ask us about if it's something you're interested in. And we'll probably try to find something that achieves that goal better.
Yeah, good summary, Joel. You touched on it. Gold's really a commodity, just like oil. And, you know, getting the price of oil right 6 months, a year out, 2 years out, is proven to be very, very difficult. There's too many economic variables that really affect the supply and demand dynamics of most commodities, gold included. So, again, we always tie it back to, can we value an asset? And gold is a tough one. Nonetheless, if you're enamored with gold and want to have 3 to 5% of your portfolio in it, there are worse mistakes to make in the world. But as Joel said, particularly from an inflation standpoint, you can't beat long-term stock holdings over time. So thanks for that, Joel. Ed, if you could just touch on, we've talked about the value and the growth differences in past weeks in terms of what's driving market performance, but there's another small item at play, which is just the what's leading the market and what's really driven markets year to date. Could you touch on that?
Sure, Ian. Thanks, and good morning, everybody. We do look at indices. We try to look at sectors, and we try to determine what on earth is driving things from time to time. And the market, as Ian mentioned, has rallied tremendously from the lows on March 23rd, down 3.3% as of last night. But it's interesting, the market's extremely bifurcated, probably about as narrow as I've ever seen. And really, it's driven by five stocks. And I'm going to give you the year-to-date returns for these five stocks, and then we'll drill into it a little bit more thoroughly. The least of these five great stocks this year is Google. It's up 7.2%. The next stock is Apple. It's up 10.6%. Then Facebook, it's up about 12%. And then Microsoft, it's up a little over 17%. And lastly, Amazon, it's up 34%. That's year to date. So if you had a portfolio that was equal weighted those five stocks, that portfolio would be up 16%. Again, the S&P 500 is down 3.3. And if you, interestingly, subtract those five stocks from the S&P 500, the S&P 500 would be down not 3.3, it'd be down 6.2%. So there's five stocks that are up a lot, and there's 495 stocks that are down a little bit to a lot. And so it has been a very tough year to pick stocks. None of these tech stocks are particularly cheap at this point. They've all had tremendous runs, and arguably they've been huge beneficiaries of the whole remote working environment. Facebook is an advertiser. Amazon largely makes all of its money at AWS, its hosting service. Apple is just Apple. It's hardware and software. Microsoft, massive beneficiary of remote work, and same with Google. So they have been in the right place at the right time, and certainly their numbers have proven it. But they have been pulling the market as a whole. If you have been a dividend investor, you've trailed these indices like the S&P 500, largely because so those are some of the stocks, the 495 that are down. And they're down because their guidance was pulled, and highly likely that you're going to see numbers down 10 to 15% this year for sales and profits. There's expectations that that'll get better next year, and that's been developed, and it's discounted into the market already for 2021. But as a whole, that's what's happened so far this year. So we've become a little bit more cautious on big cap tech. They've done great. It's already reflected in the price, and that's pulled the market up tremendously. And it's a little bit of a misconception that the market's only down 3%, because again, if you pull those five out, it actually is down, 6%, which represents something close to the market expectation of down 10% for the year. So that's where we are from a market bifurcation perspective. And it always does pay to look closely at this stuff, because it does change. It does move around. It's just not useful to look at an index. An index is comprised of a lot of securities underneath it, and there's sometimes undercurrents that are driving things a little bit more specifically that you should be aware of. Back to you, Ian.
Yeah, thank you, Ed, for that. I appreciate it. Good commentary, and it really also feeds into the value growth discussion, because those five companies you mentioned happen to be in the growth universe. So when we talk about growth outperforming value, that's all kind of tied into together. And I think your summary of those five companies gets even more specific into really what's driving the markets this year. So thank you for that. I did get a question via email as I was on this call. We've been mentioning bad numbers that we're expecting. What should we expect? Just to kind of summarize, I mean, I think, as I mentioned, tomorrow we're going to get a 20% unemployment rate, give or take a percent or so. We expect corporate earnings to probably hit their worst level in the second and third quarters of this year. And then we expect things to kind of start rebounding in the fourth quarter and certainly into next year. It's really the 2021 picture that's the hardest for everyone, frankly, to get their hands around at this point, because there still remains considerable unknowns as we look into 2021. The market has largely assumed that the corporate earnings numbers for 2020 are going to be pretty bad, given that we've sort of self-imposed a shutdown of our economy for a good couple of months now that we're working our way out of that. So 2020 numbers are going to be pretty bad. We're more concerned, and we think the market is probably going to react more closely to what transpires in 2021 as we work our way out of that. And we won't know what that looks like until we get much closer to that period of time. So it's why we've on these calls been saying that we're certainly not out of the woods from an economic standpoint. There's still a lot to kind of sift through over the coming months and quarters as we work our way through this. And we'll continue to watch the data as we always do and make good long-term fundamental-based investment decisions across asset classes, given the information we know. So thank you so much for joining us again on this call. We'll be here same time, same place next Thursday. Keep an eye out for the email call-in instructions. And have a good rest of your week. Thanks so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.